Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 1st, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Happy May Day, folks. We got work strikes, rent strikes. On the program today, we'll be talking to Heather Parton, or Digby, for this casual Friday. Then we will be talking to Winsome Pendergrass, organizer with New York Communities for Change on those very rent strikes. Then we will be talking to Judy Gold for some visceral relief at the end of this week that is beginning to bear down on us. Meanwhile, Joe Biden unequivocally denies the assault charge, releases a statement, opens the National Archives for a search, and talks to Mika and Joe. Meanwhile, as the restrictions ease up, so do infections, and so too liability and support for workers. Liability down for corporations, support for workers also down. All 50 governors get better marks than Trump on handling the coronavirus. Capitol physician says the Senate can't test the senators and the staff if they return. Mike Elk at Payday Report reports that 4,400 meatpackers have COVID as OSHA relaxes standards. Armed thugs crash the Michigan State House, call for more coronavirus deaths because freedom. Tensions mount as the Supreme Court soon to rule on the status hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients. New report shows that Trumpistas fudged research to ease Consumer Financial Protection Bureau regulations on payday loans, and those new easing of regulations about to be announced. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. It is a casual Friday. I am wearing my soft collared shirt. I have spent more time prepping this morning than I have primping, so I'm a little bit scraggly. Appreciate your being here. I don't know about you, but I'm like really the juxtaposition of the normalcy and the sort of state of crisis is really beginning to wear on me a little bit. So a little tense today. We will get to, and I will bring this up when Digby gets here, but Heather Parton and I, we do a regular segment on Ring of Fire every week, which is released as a podcast. We may at one point try and do something where we integrate it with a membership here at the Majority Report. We're still working on thinking about how we would do that. But Digby and I spent about 35 minutes talking about the Joe Biden thing, particularly in the Tara Reid accusations against him. It was before what happened this morning. And so it actually, but I think just as relevant because we set basically a standard. So we will talk about it, but there's other things to discuss as well. And so I would encourage you to go and listen to that show if you want to hear more of that conversation. But we will sum it up when she gets here. Of course, we're now in this sort of a nebulous zone in New York anyways. Cuomo has confirmed what I think everybody knew, and certainly Bill de Blasio had announced a couple of weeks ago that the kids would not be returning to school this year. And we're in a very, very strange time. We'll talk more with Digby about that. But let's play this clip. Joe Biden on Morning Joe with Mika Brzezinski. And here he is coming out, and what I think is very important, particularly for him to do at this point. And, you know, there's a couple of different takes on this in terms of the sort of the ethical and moral questions and the sheer political questions. But here's Joe Biden on Morning Joe addressing the question of these allegations.
She says in 1993, Mr. Vice President, that you pinned her against the wall and reached under her clothing and penetrated her with your fingers. Would you please go on the record with the American people? Did you sexually assault Tara Reid?
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
Do you remember her? Do you remember any types of complaints that she might have made?
I don't remember any type of complaint she may have made. It was 27 years ago. And I don't remember, nor does anyone else that I'm aware of. And the fact is that I don't remember. I don't remember any complaint ever having been made.
Have you or your campaign, have you reached out to her?
No, I have not reached out to her. It's 27 years ago. This never happened. And when she first made the claim, we made it clear that it never happened. And that's as simple as that.
In the past 30 minutes or so, you released a statement on Medium, and among other things, you write this. There's only one place a complaint of this kind could be: the National Archives. I am requesting that the Secretary of State ask the Archives to identify any record of the complaint she alleges she filed. If there was any such complaint, the record will be there. Are you preparing us for a complaint that might be revealed in some way? Are you confident there is nothing?
I'm confident there's nothing. No one ever brought it to the attention of me 27 years ago. This is any assertion at all. No one that I'm aware of in my campaign, my Senate office at the time, is aware of any such request and or any such complaint. And so I'm not worried about it at all. If there is a complaint, that's where it would be. That's where it would be filed. And if it's there, put it out. But I've never seen it. No one has that I'm aware of.
So there it is. Mika goes on to suggest, well, what about, and we'll talk about this later, but she goes on to ask, like, you know, what about the University of Delaware records? These are a different set of records that that are his office's personal, not personal, but his office's records. And the complaint that would have been filed with the Senate, with a Senate office. So the National Archives is where it would be. We can talk more about this with Digby. My understanding is, in the context of the interview with Katie Halper, that she did say that she filled out a complaint form. With what sounded like, I mean, she couldn't remember the specifics. I mean, I don't know who would, with a, I guess, what would be like a Senate or some type of congressional HR office. And so if they exist, the complaint exists, it would exist there. It's unclear whether she would have, what she would have, you know, how specific she would have been about the complaint, but at least we will get a sense of this. We will talk more about this with Digby, but from, as a political matter, you know, this is exactly what he needed to do. I don't know if it will sort of calm the waters for him or not, but this is what needed to happen. His statement, I thought, was, if I was tasked with writing a statement, I would have written something very similar like this. They're not attacking Tara Reid. They are accepting the fact that she has the right to make these assertions, and they're categorically denying it. I mean, in many respects, this is up to the American people at this point as to how they're going to react to this. We'll see. In the meantime, this ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. Meanwhile, the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they would have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and voter roll purges. And now a progressive movement is rising up to fight back, because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. We simply can't trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/majority. That's demandjustice.org/majority. This organization, I am very pleased to you know, read an ad from these guys. I interviewed Brian Fallon, I don't know, months and months and months ago on Ring of Fire radio. And it's an organization, you know, I've been watching with keen interest since he came out and said that he wants to put together basically a list, a la what the Heritage Foundation did for Donald Trump, a list of federal judiciary potential nominees, all of whom are not corporate lawyers, which I think is really hugely important. Meanwhile, I know we've talked about this app in the past. I'm still as busy as ever now that I got to, you know, deal with the kids homeschooling and just their sheer insanity. So if you're having a tough time sitting down and finding time to read, like my kids have some type of radar or something. I'm not sure exactly what you would call it, but whenever I start to read, all hell breaks loose. There's an incredible app called Blinkist. It's going to be your new secret weapon for learning new things and getting ahead. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need to know information from thousands of nonfiction books, condenses them down to just 15 minutes. You can read them or you can listen to them on your app. That app works on the phone. It works on your tablet. It works on your web browser. It's made for busy people who want to get to the main points of a book quickly. Or for people like myself who are not just busy, but also, like, you know, there's just some books I see that I feel like I should know what's in them, but I'm not going to invest the time that it takes to read the entire book. I got to say, that for me is what the hook is on Blinkist. Something you can, you work out, you can get the main points of a book within 15 minutes. For myself, this is what it's basically for me, just a way of looking at books that, you know, I wouldn't read. You know, Fukuyama's got a book out, Political Order, Political Decay. That's the kind of book that I'm like, I'm not going to read that whole book.
No, the first one in the series is pretty good.
Is it?
For Fukuyama, yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I will read that one. It's also like that. a way of digging in and deciding if I'm gonna. Have you ever heard of this book by Amy Chow, Chua, I think, Political Tribes? I feel like I've heard of it.
No, I haven't.
But that's something that I'm like, oh, key takeaways. I want to know what the political tribes are. Stuff like, I don't know, even they have a Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom. I mean, that one I could see doing a short version, but that is maybe one I would make Myla listen to or read. There's all sorts of things that Blinkist, they have all sorts of, you know, sort of how to better yourself type of books. The 4-Hour Work Week is my big fave. Tim Ferriss on there. But, you know, maybe you want to find out what Rachel Maddow's last book was like, Blowout. Well, you don't want to read the whole thing? 15 minutes, that's all it takes. Read that American Carnage on the front lines of the Republican Civil War, the rise of Donald Trump. You can't stomach it? 15 minutes, you can listen or read it. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all for one low price. For a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for Majority Report listeners. That's what you do. You go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report. You try it for free for 7 days. If you want to continue on, you will save 25% on your new subscription. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Start your 7-day free trial, then save 25% on your membership. Sign up now, Blinkist.com/Majority Report. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Someone who, just because we have now, well, I guess we've always been socially distant from our next guest. However, we have always been in close proximity to this little ditty.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah. Are you ready?
Oh, I never realized that it said just rub it on you, so good for you. That was. I love that.
I didn't either. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, that really worked for me. It's an excellent song for quarantine, I think.
Yes.
I think it really, everyone should listen to that at least once a day.
And we had a good graphic that went with that as well, actually, today. I don't know if that went out to folks. So, Heather, I was telling people before you came on that you and I for Ring of Fire – which is available as a podcast. I think it's already out. Discussed at great length, probably longer than we had, much longer than we would ever want to, but certainly longer than we had anticipated. The Tara Reid Joe Biden situation, and there's obviously some new developments this morning in terms of Biden putting out a statement and going on the Morning Joe show. So let's just, you know, recap what we talked about yesterday briefly and how this implicates it. And we should say up front, like, I know that there would be just about anybody else in the race, maybe short of a couple of other people, that you would want as opposed to Joe Biden. I think you know that about me. And I also just to set the framework of this conversation. I think it's very hard for me to see how there can be any type of like really major public pressure brought to bear against Joe Biden that wouldn't make a significant number of people who voted for Joe Biden, and I would argue maybe the vast majority of them, feel like they have been, you know, sort of disenfranchised in some way. I think the only way, there's only two ways out of this, it seems to me. One is Joe Biden gets past it, or Joe Biden steps down. Just recap what we had said yesterday, and then we can talk about sort of the next sort of, I guess, installment of this.
Well, you know, as you said, I mean, it was a very in-depth conversation. If you're interested in our views on this, I would hope that everybody would tune into that podcast, because we went really deep and I think hit a lot of the nuance of this story and the political implications, which I think we're all concerned with, regardless of where we stand on the particular issue. The political implications are, you know, vast and extremely important. We're in the middle of a global catastrophe. We have an absolute, you know, ignoramus at the helm. Now he's starting to gin up some kind of a war with China. I mean, this is crazy time. And the fact that we're all on lockdown and it's very unlikely that there's going to be a real convention in the summer makes the idea of replacing the candidate, unless, as you point out, he steps down, the idea of trying to do that in any way that would bring confidence to the American people that the Democrats are actually better at, you know, perhaps leading us out of this catastrophe, I think that brings that into question. So we've got a real problem on our hands, and I think we acknowledged that and went through it. And I'll just address, if you want to, you know, hear more about that, listen to the majority report, or to the Ring of Fire. But I will say this, because this morning, it was a little early for me, so I only caught some of it, and then read the statement, of course. And you and I had both talked about the way that people, that any politician who gets into this kind of a, you know, a situation in a campaign, the way that they can deal with it appropriately. And we talked about how, you know, Barack Obama dealt with the Reverend Wright thing and all that. And we talked, you know, about the history and people like Gary Hart, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, and our feeling was, is that it was very important for Biden to come out and say something. We didn't know when we did it, and it was just hours before that it was announced that he was going to, that he had to come out and he had to say things and he had to do it in a certain way in order to be respectful of his accuser, respectful of women generally, respectful of the issue, the larger issue here that we're all kind of still, you know, grappling with. And I don't think we ever said that he could just put it behind him. That's never going to happen. I think we all know that. This issue will be out there. But the question is whether or not it will be something that, you know, the right will certainly try to weaponize it, but whether it will be something that's so salient, barring any new information, of course, that it actually forces him to resign, which I think you and I both agree is the only way that this could happen. And even then, Sam, the process for trying to replace him will be ugly and messy,
right?
And really, really difficult. So So I think my opinion is, just to, you know, put it into this, is that I think he did fine with that. The process has begun of dealing with this thing that's been hanging out there for a long time. I think he waited too long, but he did it. And his statement was good, I thought. You know, he gave due respect to the issue itself, and he did not in any way demean her, which is a very important thing. And, you know, he denied it unequivocally. There's still a lot of stuff hanging out about, you know, his records and all that, and we that's not the end of it. We're going to be hearing about that for a long time. And I'm sort of agnostic on the political wisdom of opening up those records, but, you know, that will be dealt with in due course. The main issue of how Joe Biden responded, I think the first step that he took today worked out pretty well. I think he was, you know, confident and compassionate and was caught, the most important part, cognizant of the seriousness of the issue. I think that came through. So that's where I am today. Who knows what'll happen tomorrow, right? I mean, these are the kind of stories that just, they unfold and they just keep, you know, there's always things coming. And don't, I just want to warn everybody, anybody who thinks that the fact that Donald Trump has NDAs on, you know, behind, I don't know how many hundreds of women, how many people he's paid off, how many women have accused him credibly, how much we have him on tape saying things like grab him by the pussy. No matter how much of that stuff is out there, he is 100% shameless, and he will use this.
Right. Just, without a doubt.
You just don't even think, you know, for a second that somehow that's neutralized because of Donald Trump. I mean, we'll be screaming it, you know, how dare he? What about Trump? But it won't make any difference. So just get ready. If the rallies resume or whatever he has to do, this will become part of the story. It is part of the story. And, you know, on a political level, I think everybody just has to accept that. And the other thing we can hope is that, you know, it doesn't sort of metastasize into something so damaging that, you know, it hurts Joe Biden, but he refuses to step down. That's the worst possible scenario as we go down the road. But for the moment, I think we're sort of, you know, we are where we are. And,
yeah.
You know, I didn't think it was too bad. I guess I'll just say that.
Right. I mean, I you know, my feeling is, and I think the way that we talked about this, there was two basic buckets which you have to address is, like, you know, the veracity of the allegations and the political analysis. And from a veracity of the allegations thing, like, we're never going to know the truth. That's just, right. We can't know the truth. I, you know, personally, I think that I can understand, reason for skepticism because of the sort of the nature of how, the accusation has sort of rolled out over time a little bit. But I also, I'm of the mind that, you know, it's very hard to judge someone who has been through something like that. And to assess, you know, and by judge, I mean, like, you know, assess, like, I don't know how I would react in that scenario. I have no idea. I'm so far away removed from it. And certainly, you know, there's research that shows that, you know, people's stories evolve. They're, you know, I mean, one doesn't know. And so I don't think what happened was so out of character of Joe Biden or the time, frankly. So it's not impossible for me to believe. But, you know, generally, and maybe there would be value in having some type of outside investigation, but he's sort of, on some level, it's happening, right? I mean, there are many, many reporters who are looking into this. Certainly, they're going to, now that he's, you know, given permission to the National Archives to release any information regarding any complaints that may have been levied by her at that time, you know, we have, in some sorts, an investigation. And I think that is wholly appropriate. You know, the personal documents that he has from the office, I don't think are relevant. It's certainly, the complaint certainly wouldn't be there. And, the last thing I want is another sort of, like, he had a server in his basement at one point or so. Exactly. Type of situation. And so I think that's wise in terms of the political analysis. And in terms of the political analysis, I think, you know, you and I, like we said yesterday, he's like, he's going to come out and he's going to address this, and he's going to stop looking to other people to, you know, deflect. He's going to come and address this head on to the extent that he has the ability to do so, which I frankly perceive as, you know, relatively limited in terms of just his skill sets right now. I think he did fairly well. It's a little bit graded on a curve. And yeah, I'm with you that this is not going to go away. And the question is, will he have convinced enough Democratic voters that the people who want to continue to push this and are interested in pushing it, both for, I think, you know, good faith and bad faith reasons, because I think there's both out there, frankly. And I'm not talking on the right. On the right, I think a lot of it's bad faith, obviously. But on the left, on the left, broadly speaking, I think there's good faith. I think there's bad faith. You know, I got an email from a listener, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. It was rather, it was pretty moving, and it was long, and we're just going to refer to her as listener CJ. But the gist of it was that she is a rape victim, survivor, and she has, you know, this moments like this are very, very painful, particularly for people who have been through something like this. They see the response to the allegations that Tara Reid had, and she wasn't raped by anyone who was, you know, a public figure in any way. But they see these allegations and the response to these allegations, and it has a visceral impact on them. And she said, I don't think I can bring myself to vote for Joe Biden because of that. However, I would encourage everybody to vote for Joe Biden because, you know, there are much, much larger things at stake. And it was an interesting sort of take on this where she's like, I physically don't know that I have the ability to do it.
I totally respect that.
I really do too.
I respect that position. And I, let me just say this too. Normally, you know, in the case of somebody, let's just use Al Franken, for instance. You know, there was a lot of controversy about those charges, and there still was a lot of bitterness among a lot of people who think that they were not, it wasn't properly adjudicated, or that he was unfairly tagged, and you know, the whole thing. And I understand that. And, you know, I have a strong sense of justice. I'm a big civil libertarian, this kind of thing. You know, there's a whole part of me, I'm torn, right? As a woman, as a feminist, as a person who cares about civil liberties and, you know, justice, all that bothers me. But when I think about someone like Al Franken, for instance, I think, you know, it's a shame that that happened, if it was unfair, if it was whatever. But, you know, it's just a job with him. He was replaced by a fine senator. It's not the end of the world, right? This isn't the end of the world if Al Franken isn't the senator anymore. I mean, we can carry on. There was no legal ramification. He wasn't going to lose his freedom. He was going to lose a job that was dependent on the public, you know, voting for him. This is a different situation, and sort of plays into what you said about your email correspondent. You know, this is not, it's Joe Biden won't go to jail over this. The statute of limitations is long past. The evidence is too flimsy, probably, for any kind of a criminal case. But, and normally I'd say, hey, you know, but it's bad enough that maybe this guy shouldn't be a senator or whatever. But because of the situation that we're in, because of the messiness of trying to replace him under anything but, you know, the most dire circumstances, the fact that we're faced with, you know, an election that looks much closer than it should be under the circumstances, and we're in the middle of a global catastrophe, the stakes are way, way, way higher than they usually are. And that's why you can see someone like this person saying, you know, I can't do it because my own personal, you know, I can't. But please don't let, you know, don't let that be a reason for you not to do it because the stakes are so high. And I really respect that position because the stakes are so high. I mean, this is much, much bigger than your normal situation. I mean, if Harvey Weinstein loses his job and his company, it's not the end of the world. If Donald Trump wins again, it may be the end of the world. So we're having to take into consideration a whole set of issues that are playing into this that are much bigger than we normally do in this situation. So, you know, I would just say that that person, you know, good for her for being able to sort of say that despite her own personal pain at having to deal with something like this.
I agree. I was terribly impressed by that stance where, you know, completely understandable you would have a painful visceral reaction to it, but also to be able to sort of step back and even with that, even feeling that kind of pain, realize that there's a lot of other people who are going to be suffering,
right,
as a function of Donald Trump winning a re-election. And, you know, at one point, I think there's also, you know, just to pivot back to the political and then we'll move on. I do think that there is, you know, has been, and I think this is where we were at yesterday, like a legitimate political concern founded on that same attitude that the emailer expressed for encouraging people to vote for Biden, that this would make this would hurt Biden's chances of winning. And that is, I think, you know, where we were yesterday when we were talking about this and positing like he's going to have to do something like X. And we'll see if that, you know, salvages and he's able to put this behind him. That X happened today and we will see if it was enough. So I you know, the one thing that I am sort of like, you know, and I have been relentless in my criticism and I feel like well warranted of Biden's campaign and his abilities and prior to that, his policies and whatnot. But I'm glad they did this today as opposed to yes, waiting anymore. From a political perspective, this needs to be resolved, at least in terms of what they're going to do and how people are going to react as soon as possible. Because if there is, if Biden has a failure to get past this, we all need to know sooner rather than later. Yeah. And then we also got to, you know, hope that there isn't another, that there aren't more accusations out there that we haven't heard beyond the fact that we all know the guy doesn't seem to have any respect for anybody's personal space right, as a matter of course. But we, you know, that's where we're at. All right, let's pivot from that, Heather, because again, we, you know, we just added another 15 minutes to that conversation that we did yesterday at 35. I mean,
one of those
new information. But there's a lot going on right now in terms of what you wrote about this a couple of days ago, and nothing's changed. It's gotten a little more extreme. We are looking at a new era of a confederacy, if you will, and it is happening in slightly a different way. I mean, I guess, I mean, maybe it isn't, maybe it is. Let's just play this clip of Donald Trump. This is him yesterday at his, whatever it is, the show he puts on, The Daily Show, where he is talking about the Republican states being in better shape than the Democrat states. And of course, you know, one of the things that helps when you're dealing with a pandemic is to not have density. And the reality is that these states are simply not as dense as let's say, New York, right? But here is Donald Trump yesterday. Basically, you know, it was quite a juxtaposition between this and Obama's there's no red America, there's no blue America. But go ahead.
What's happening is the Democrats have come to us and they'd like to do a phase four. And we'll think about what's happening. They want to help the states. They want to help bailouts. And, you know, bailouts are very tough. And they happen to be Democrat states. It's California, it's New York, it's Illinois. You start with those three. And the Republican states are in strong shape. You know, I don't know. Is that luck or is that talent? Or is it just a different mentality? But the Republican run states are in strong shape. Look, I looked today when I spoke with Ron DeSantis. He was here yesterday, as I said, and Florida is doing incredibly. Texas is doing incredibly. These states are doing unbelievably. They don't know about the word bailout. We had a call from a governor of South Dakota, and they have one of the finest run states. They have a constitutional amendment. They're not allowed to, you know, they have to have a balanced budget, and they have a balanced, totally balanced budget. They just have a sales tax. It's about the only tax they have is a sales tax. I mean, think of that. So it's a whole different thing. But Republican states are doing very well. Maybe the Democrats should have brought this up earlier when we wanted certain things. And they did. And we said, and I said specifically, no, let's look at it later on down the road. But they'd like to do something. They want to do infrastructure. I can understand infrastructure. Think of it. We've spent $8 trillion in the Middle East, and we're not fixing our roads in this country? How stupid. How stupid is it? And we're not fixing our highways, our tunnels, our bridges, our hospitals even, our schools even. It's crazy. But they want to do things, and the Republicans are in a much better position from, you know, I don't want to use the word negotiating position, but we really are. We're in a negotiating position that's different because they want to bail out various states. Illinois is in big trouble. The governor understands that. Pritzker, he understands that. But Illinois is in big trouble.
So, I mean, there you have it. He's basically saying, like, you know, nice states you have there. Be a real shame if something happened to it, but we're in a position where we own the purse strings. Now, we should also say, you know, one of the ways that Florida has helped itself from a fiscal standpoint is it has denied about 95% of the unemployment claims coming from 1.5 million people there. And so this is all on the backs of people who have lost their jobs. I mean, just the unbelievable immiseration of people is basically what the metric has been. If you have been able to discipline your plebes, then maybe you come to the king and you get some diamonds and gold. I mean, that's basically what's going on here.
Well, that's absolutely right. First, can I just say that every time I hear his voice, that, you know, something just, you know, I feel a white hot heat go from the tip of my toes to the top of my head. It's really becoming a serious problem for me. Listening to that litany of lies, that smug ignorance of his, it's really hard to take. And in this particular situation, first of all, it's complete and utter nonsense that the only states that will be in need of help from the federal government in this situation are Democratic states. It's ridiculous. Even Florida, by the way, is one of them. It's on the list. Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's state. I mean, he's going to have one of the worst problems with public pensions of all. Now, he's perfectly willing, I'm sure, to just completely trash the public pension program in Kentucky and just say, let it go bankrupt. I have no doubt. He is fine with that. That's, you know, part of Mitch McConnell. And this is kind of a pincher sort of a tactic here, because you got Trump on the one hand saying, well, you know, maybe some sanctuary cities, maybe you could give me a little bit of that. And McConnell on the other hand is saying, well, maybe you could get rid of some of your public pensions and, you know, maybe go bankrupt on that. They're doing this. They're using this, as we've seen in the past, you know, the whole disaster capitalism shock doctrine method that these people use. Not that Trump knows about that, but, you know, he's sort of instinctively, you know, good at that, to try and break the public employees in states and use this as an excuse to do it. It's absolutely horrific. And it's also just nonsense. I mean, California, for instance, had a huge rainy day fund. It was really, really great. I mean, you know, they'd been building up all kinds of, you know, money for this. And as a result, their shortfall isn't that much compared to what you see in New York or some of the other states that have been hard hit, Illinois. But it's still, the rainy day fund in this state is gone now. I mean, there'll be a slight shortfall. They're going to need money. Certainly the cities need money as well as the states. And, you know, they did all the right things. You know, they do have a public, you know, a big, you know, issue coming up with their public pensions, as do all states virtually. But this is an absolutely disgusting ploy on the part of Trump and his henchmen in the Republican Party to do this thing and to use this as an excuse and to sit there and just, you know, actually declare. To me, it sounds like he was just declaring war on the blue states, just saying, you know, look, any state that's run by a Democrat is my enemy. That's just the way it is. And all you people, and by the way, there are some Trump voters in those states, too. There's plenty of them. You know, there's plenty of Trump voters in California. You see them waving their flags and talking about, you know, bailouts and all this other stuff on the streets here, too, just like you do in Michigan. They're not armed here, but, you know, whatever. But I mean, this whole idea comes down to what I wrote about this week, which is, and I didn't get the idea, I didn't come up with it myself. I got it from Ron Klain, who was Obama's Ebola czar. But he had said a few weeks ago on Chris Hayes' show that basically what's happened is that we sort of reverted to the Articles of Confederation. And the main point of that being is that under the Articles of Confederation, which were before the Constitution was ratified, there was no president. In fact, the reason that they decided they needed a constitution and needed to create a stronger central government was because you could not defend the country. You couldn't protect the country, their fragile little country that they had just fought for, without some kind of a central government led by a leader of some sort. You know, no surprise they picked George Washington to be the first one. So we don't have a president. The president is not doing anything to actually, you know, protect the country as a whole, which is his main job. Basically, what he's done is declare war on people who didn't vote for him. That's what he has done. And to the extent that he's done anything, it's been to mess things up, not to make anything better. Even to the point where, you know, you've got people like Larry Hogan, a Republican, by the way, in Maryland, saying that he has to protect his, you know, the masks that he personally sent his wife over to South Korea to try and get for his own healthcare workers, that he had to protect them with the National Guard when somebody asked him, you know, so are you worried that FEMA's going to come and hijack your mask? And he says, well, we don't have to worry about that. I've got the National Guard protecting it. Now, if that doesn't sound like war, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is crazy.
We had that clip. We'll play that clip. We'll play that clip later. But yeah, it's sheer insanity that, I mean, and it's just like, because the last time this happened was during the civil rights era, right? Where the National Guard was federalized and, you know, to promote desegregation. And, we on the left, as it were, are on the other side of this, right? Where when the feds show up, it's a problem because they're stealing the personal protection equipment for the states. When, you know, the feds are taking their ball and you know, using their power to procure these things and then, you know, basically selling it off to the highest bidder. I mean, it really is a really bizarre situation that we're dealing with. And, you know, there does not seem to be a cohesive countervailing force, right? I mean, there's, you know, certainly not in DC. Like, I'm not seeing the communication or there's no institutional structure, it feels like, for the blue state governors to, and maybe they're doing it behind the scenes, but to coordinate with the congressional leaders that we need to, you know, make sure that we're getting, you know, and part of the problem is also the agendas of the Democratic leadership. You know, and I'm thinking specifically things like, you know, the expansion of COBRA versus the expansion of Medicaid. You know, I mean, in New York, Andrew Cuomo and I suspect our next guest, who we're going to bring on shortly, can amplify this. But Andrew Cuomo has been cutting Medicaid in the middle of this pandemic, and you know, an expansion of Medicaid, let's say, would be just what we need, both, you know, from a fiscally disciplined way, but, you know, there's the leadership of the Democratic Party, at least in Congress, does not want to buck the insurance companies and is going to bail them out. I would imagine there's a whole host of things that Democratic governors would want, and that we don't have the same sort of infrastructure here, and we don't necessarily have champions in the House who have the strength that we need to champion some of those things. I mean, there'll be some things, surely, but it's a problem.
Sam, they're not even coming to work. I mean, you know, this week there was this, you and I talked about this earlier, that, you know, why are they not considering themselves essential workers? I mean, my grocery store down the street here has a bunch of people who come to work every day in the middle of this thing. It's not particularly safe for them, but they're doing it. They're trying to protect themselves. They're doing what they can, but because it's essential that we get to buy food. I cannot, for the life of me, understand why the House of Representatives is not in session. I just don't get it. I can't believe they can't come up with a way to socially distance and keep themselves protected. I know that many of them are in a high-risk group, but I still believe that this is one of those times when really that kind of leadership would be important. And I'm not saying that they should run around without masks or do a Mike Pence or anything. You know, they need to model proper behavior, but they are essential workers. And the fact that they're not doing it, and then they tried to do it, you know, if there were people saying, well, you know, maybe we really should come back. And apparently it was the rank and file, or at least that's what we were told, that rose up in you know, opposition saying, no, we don't want to come back. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't buy it either. And I just find it, I have to assume this is some kind of a political calculation that, you know, let Trump just, you know, turn in his own, you know, mess here and we won't really, but it's bad. It's giving a very, very bad image, I think, of the Democrats, even forgetting the Pelosi and ice cream thing, but just in general, the idea, and it was like kind of refreshing, you know, when they did come back to do the vote. And you see them there, and they were, you know, wearing masks and socially distancing and doing all that. And the Republicans were making asses of themselves, you know, doing their bit. But whatever, I'm going, okay, they're functioning here. And then, you know, the whole thing falls apart. Well, we're going to recess again. I will never understand this. I think this is the strangest decision on their part. This is a time when they should be, and I'm not saying that you just politicize every single thing that's going on, but this is political. Donald Trump has made this political.
Listen, there is every aspect of this is political. It was political before it hit in terms of like how prepared we were for this, both ranging from, you know, all our pandemic readiness that had been undercut because of an ideology and the fact that as a country, look, we are suffering unemployment in a way that no other country in the world is. And that is because of a political policy decision. We are suffering in terms of healthcare in ways that no other country, at least industrialized countries, are suffering because of political policy decisions that have been made in this country for decades. And so we were ill-suited to deal with something like this because of it from just a structural standpoint. And we have a party that is using this to make structural change to America. They are going, I mean, you know, that's the thing. Like, there is no not making structural change in this environment. It's just the Republicans are doing it and saying they're not doing it. And the Democrats are doing just like they're just bailing water. They're not taking a position. And part of it is because that's part of their agenda too, that they don't have a problem with some of these structural changes, or to the extent that they do, they are trying to kid themselves that we can get out of this with just like, we'll just go back to normal. No, that's not happening. That's not happening. We will find a new normal, but it will be one where there are no small businesses. We will find a new normal, but it will be one where there is massive wealth inequality. The, you know, like the, there is, this is one of those situations where it's like, you have to make a choice. The only bad decision, you know, and doing these half measures or these stopgap things, all you're doing, the best analogy I can give is saying, I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. If you show up the way that the Democratic Congress is showing up now, you're basically signing off on their agenda. There is no other option. It is you forge a new, radically different option, or you accept theirs, period. There is no going back to some half measures. That's just a joke. But
I don't even understand the political calculation, because
I don't either.
I don't understand why they don't want to be sitting there, you know, being in session and holding hearings and doing this kind of, you know, being active. And saying, you know, I mean, because they're saying, well, look, you know, we couldn't get the help for the states in this one. We'll get it in the next one. And then we'll do this for hospitals in the next one after that, you know, doing this same sort of incremental, kind of relief bills. Shouldn't they be showing that they're working on those incremental relief bills if that's what they want to do? I mean, how the hell do we even know what they're doing? We don't see any negotiation. We see nothing. It's like this void. And all you've got is Donald Trump coming along and telling people to drink bleach. I mean, it's really very unnerving, I think, for the average citizen to see what their government is doing right now or not doing, basically.
Indeed. Well, Heather, thank you so much for your time today. Maybe next week will be slightly better. I don't know.
I wouldn't count.
I wouldn't either. Heather Parton, folks, check out Hullabaloo. Head over there. She's got a tip jar. You can also see, read her stuff at Salon. Heather Parton Digby, thank you so much. Always, always a real pleasure. All right.
Have a great weekend, Sam. Thanks.
You too. All right, folks. Let's just bring our next guest, Winsome Pendergrass, into on air now. Winsome, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So, Winsome, thank you for holding. I know that you were waiting for a little bit. So, I know that you have been an organizer for Housing Justice with New York Communities for Change. Give me a broad sense of what's happening today and why.
Okay, so I'm not really an organizer. I am a delegate, but I work closely with the organizers of Housing Justice for All, and I'm a member of New York Communities for Change. So for far too long, we have noticed here in New York City that the poor set of people, the people who can't talk for themselves, the people who don't have resources are struggling and suffering. Gentrification and dislocation has taken over the population and the places that black and brown people as always have as a thriving community. And to make matters worse, the powers that be in Albany, they don't address the system of how cruel it is to poor people, children included. So right now I'm thinking we have 100,000 people in shelters and in New York City. The trains, when a train pull up into a station and you see two cars empty, we in New York know not to go into those cars that are empty. It's not that there is not seat, but that it is taken up by homeless people. So we have to cram in other cars like sardine tins. We are asking, we have been asking, we have been petitioning, we have had petition sign left, right, and center. And we have talked to all the legislators, the assembly members, and to Governor Cuomo. He doesn't really want to talk to us, but we know he hears our plea that the housing crisis is getting out of hand. Then comes COVID-19. Boom. It explodes. There are people in shelters who are not wearing masks. They have not been tested. Some people even left the hospital, have no home for themselves. They go right back into a shelter where possible the virus is already existing. the landlords are trying to play as if they're a victim here, but we know that they're covered by 421A. A lot of people don't know that.
What is 421A?
421A is a government program that landlords can get a certain amount of money to for the upkeep of their buildings. But we know that a lot of those landlords don't spend that money. They put it into an escrow account, or who knows, they might send it out of the country. The small landlords, mom and pop landlord, meaning the person who she and her granddaughter put together and buy a house, we are not fighting against them. We are fighting with them. We want their mortgages to be canceled. The banks will lend the corporate landlord any amount of money at a small interest rate. If mom and pop go into the bank and say, okay, I need some money, that landlord, that interest rate that they're going to get, that money is going to throw them out on the street also. But right now, half of New York City is not working. People who did house cleaning, a little housekeeping, might have been going home with a $350, and they might have to do a little cooking in their house or a little baking to come up with the rent, where one studio in New York is going for $1,500 every 3 weeks. Come on. We are calling on the governor to address that plight. Just a while ago, I saw Governor Cuomo in his press conference, and it's all about the nursing homes, the hospitals, da-da-da, and that is quite good. Then a reporter said, I heard the noise outside. I went outside, and we see people outside. There's a caravan outside. We have a caravan of 100 strong right now in Manhattan, and we have people doing banner drops from buildings, and we're dropping body bags at his office. Some body bags was dropped at Jeff Bezos' building, that billionaire who just refurbished his luxury apartment for $30 billion in Manhattan. And she's asking him, what do you have to say to the renters, the tenants who are suffering? He didn't even give the question a 1 minute. All he said, oh, it's not the first we have protesters. When they're in Albany, they shake the windows. They will always be protesting. But as you know, from now until June, nobody can be evicted. That's not enough. They're going to come after us with all guns drawn at the end of June. Where are we going to get the money to pay 3 months' rent if we can't come up with May's rent? So the strategy that we have today was the five boroughs. There is an action with people keeping their distance, of course, wearing their masks, but we are calling on all the representatives, but especially Governor Cuomo, to address the situation that we are in now with renters and landlords. Landlords are already asking tenants, pay with credit card or use your debit card. Landlords are already pushing eviction notice under people's door. They're calling up their lawyers and asking them, how soon can we take action? So that is why we have to, the vulnerable, you have people who are in wheelchairs. You have people who are lying in an apartment building right now with oxygen mask or something, or some kind of equipment because of the debilitating diseases or sickness that they are suffering from. Nobody's thinking about them. $1,200 stimulus check cannot help anyone in New York City or across America. And we're calling on Governor Cuomo in New York to address the system.
Winsome, what specifically, if you had the opportunity to introduce a piece of legislation or an executive order, like specifically, what would be the idea that call on the state to pay the rent, or to simply tell me exactly what, because I mean, obviously you can say, as the state has, like, you know, you can't, there's no evictions until June. Well, that's great, but it's not like you're building up a war chest of cash that you're going to be able to pay off 3 months of rent, back rent in June, that you're going to be in the exact same situation, except for presumably the landlords are going to have like all of their, you know, their paperwork ready and just to pump it into the system. What should Cuomo do? What should Democrats?
Right now, the thing on the table, 200 millionaires are living in New York and they don't pay adequate taxes. There is a small amount of millionaires who have been knocking on Governor Cuomo's door all the time when we were going to Albany fighting for the 9 bills that we wanted to pass. We were coming across a small amount of millionaires, I forgot the name they call themselves now, who were begging to be taxed to pay some more. So many millionaires buy a luxury apartment in Manhattan. They don't even live here. They're living in other parts of the world. They just come in like for a month or two. We, the everyday people, we pay the bulk of the taxes. Why can't he tax Jeff Bezos some more? And all the others, and I'm just calling, throwing his name out here because right now we are at his doorstep. We have people at his doorstep right now with body bags because he's not even protecting his workers in the warehouse over in Staten Island. But the landlords can be taxed. And there are people within our organization who have done the work. They have done the homework. And they have shown us in our briefings where they can tax the landlord with all their luxury, their helicopters, their yachts, their planes, and all the money that they have. And he could use that money to fund that situation in New York to help the poorer class of people. Look, it's like a ladder. Some are at the top of the ladder, some is in the beginning. The rest of us is trying to get our hand on the ladder so we can pull ourselves up. But the people at the top are kicking our hands off, meaning from government to the rich, they are kicking our hands off so we can't even get a space on the ladder. And that's not fair because we contribute to this lovely state. We pay taxes. We work like a dog in this taxes so that we can take care of our families. But Uncle Sam gets cut off the top. And it's not fair.
And we've definitely seen in the context of what's happening with COVID that the highest rates of infection and deaths are happening in the lowest income areas.
Yes.
And that is indicative of both a lack of medical services there, long-term and short-term, and a function of who are deemed necessary workers and who are doing what we as a society has deemed the necessary work.
Yes, sir. I have a friend who works in a nursing home. Within 4 weeks, she was sent home to self-quarantine. She went back to work on Monday, but she was afraid. She's falling into a depression. One mask for 5 days. One mask for 5 days. Every evening they leave work, they have to put it in an envelope or a paper bag and come back and use the same dirty mask the next day. Come on. The nursing homes are run by millionaires. They take people's life insurance, they take their houses, they take their social security, their pension. Come on. And nobody is talking up for those CNAs who are working in that deplorable condition. They're being covered by 1199, the union, 1199 dropped the ball. They don't even go and ask them how they're doing. They don't even ask them about the situation, the mass. And that one CNA is taking care of 11 to 13 patients in an 8-hour span. Come on.
So, Winsome, now, how much are you guys coordinating with organizers and activists and delegates around the country?
Well, we have been doing a lot of coordination. I myself have done a lot of Zoom call, you know, conference call with CPD, ACRI, and a whole slew of people across the country, people from Detroit, California, Maine, Pennsylvania, all over. It is so heartening to see that today, in the midst of a pandemic, people are standing up, going out. As I said, we have a car caravan of 120 strong right now between the five boroughs in New York, and I know it stretched right across the length and breadth of America. There is an amount of people from teachers union to automotive workers, even university colleges, the immigrant student, they are suffering too. Somebody gave their story the other day from Colombia that they want them to vacate the dorms and to go home, but they can't go home. So then they turn around and tack an extra $45 per day for them to pay to stay in their dorms. Jeez. That's not right.
Winsome, what can folks who are listening to this now do to help?
There are a lot of people today who join with us and they tell us point blankly, we can pay our rent, but we are standing in solidarity of the people who cannot pay. And there are downright those of us who don't have enough for this month's rent, May Day rent. We don't have it. The call is a clarion call for all uprighting citizens who have a heart and who care about humanity to join with us. We are not here to tell people that we want anything free. We are voters in our constituency and they need us to vote. We know our vote is important because the governor is not paying us any mind now, but when it's voting time, he come in the ghetto and knock on doors with us. There was a time when we were on his team, but little by little we noticed that he's not paying us any mind. He went over to corporate and he forget us. So there are people who are joining us, standing in solidarity with the many thousands and thousands of tenants who cannot pay their rent and the many thousands of children who are in shelter. They cannot go to the refrigerator and throw out a glass of milk. Better yet, they can't do the Zoom class work that the school is not asking them to do in the shelters. And if they're on the street or sleeping on a train with their parents, they really cannot do it. They're human. We are human. We need our elected official to realize the oath that they take to protect us and to look out for our well-being.
Well, Winsome Pendergrass, thank you so much for taking the time. Good luck out there. Keep us updated.
Thank you.
I hope that folks are inspired to join you in this rent strike today.
It's getting bigger. It's getting bigger.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch and like to hear an update for you, but stay safe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And you too. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Winsome Pendergrass, she's a delegate and works with New York Communities for Change as well as Housing Justice. We'll put a link to those organizations at majority.fm. Let's take a, I don't know if we have Judy yet on with us. Let me just double check. But this is happening across the country. We've got worker strikes. We've got rent strikes. Like she said, they are focusing their rent strikes on you know, real estate companies. You know, it's not a question. It's not a question of, you know, the folks you're living on the first floor of a three decker and the people who own it on the third floor and the renting for you. I mean, I don't think that's what this is about for them. It is major real estate holdings, major corporations, particularly, you know, we saw in the wake of the foreclosure crisis that we had a lot of these hedge funds going in, buying up buying up these places. What's this we're looking at? This is the this is an image of what we're seeing in New York. Cancel rent across the Queensboro Bridge. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to take a quick break here. When we do, we will be back in just a moment with Judy Gold right after this. We're back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. That was pretty moving. I hope people are out there, amplifying the voices of people who are, you know, just being churned up even more so than on a regular basis. But again, you know, the table has been set, and it is always in situations like this that the most vulnerable suffer the most, obviously, when you have something that we perceive as like hitting everyone, but it always hits those folks who have been marginalized, those folks who are lower income more than any of others. On the phone, it's been a while. I think it's been, we certainly have not heard this little ditty since the quarantining started.
Fuck you!
Cold. Hello?
Hold on.
Collected.
I have a bigger penis than him.
Judy Gold is on the line to keep us all connected.
The fuck is the matter with him?
A steady hand to guide us. She'll keep us calm and carry on.
No fucking way!
Too bad Jimmy Reefer Cuck didn't find a worthy of a song. Well, Judy Gold.
And he's such a fucking penis head liar. I'm not kidding. That's the president of the United States. That's the president. What the fuck?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the dulcet tones of Judy Gold. Judy?
Oh, Sam, thank you so much for having me. Hello to all the wonderful people over at the Majority Report. And everything
is just fantastic. Just fantastic. So, thank you for having me. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. I it's nice to hear.
Oh, please. My pleasure.
It's nice to hear that you, you seem very, at ease.
Very calm. Very calm. I'm at ease. I'm so happy. You know, not going outside for days at a time. It's really great for your mental health. Also, living through a pandemic that could have been way less severe, and having just so many people sick and dying, it's just fantastic. So just happy to be here. And, God forbid I ever get on stage in a comedy club again or go to a theater because of a fucking lying, fucking narcissistic piece of shit ruining everyone's life. Anyone who supports him should go, I'm done. I am done. I am fucking done. I'm done. That's it. There's no excuse. At this point, I don't care about your fucking money and your fucking gun. Shove them both up your fucking ass. Okay? Because this, if you don't see what a motherfucker this piece of shit lying scum is, then go fuck yourself. Hello?
Hi, Judy. I was just gonna say that it's nice to hear that, you know, you you've seemed calm, but I'd say like I get a sense, a little bit of a sense that you're upset at what's going on. I don't.
First of all, when he stood there. First of all, I'm done with Dr. Scarf. I'm done with her.
Is it Dr. Blix you're talking about? Is that it? Deborah Blix?
Dr. Burks.
Burks.
Burks. Burks. Dr. Scarf, okay? First of all, someone should take one of her scarves and fucking hang him with it. Oh, God. Okay. Oh, wait. Oh, I just called for the death of the president. Okay, wait. Write to me. Yeah, that's what I meant. Anyway, sticking the light through your skin or up your ass or wherever the fuck he was putting the goddamn light and the drinking of Clorox, like, does anyone understand how fucking, and then denying it.
Well, I mean, to be fair, okay. He just said he was being sarcastic because he wanted to mess with the reporters.
Here's the deal. A, we watched it. You weren't being sarcastic. And B, you have to be smart to be sarcastic. And you're the dumbest fucker I've ever fucking heard speak. So shut the fuck up. You don't know sarcasm. You don't know sarcasm because that would indicate intelligence.
I mean, it seems to me that, like, you know, do we really want the president of the United States, you know, up there trying to see if he can mess with reporters during a pandemic? I mean, it's one thing
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Well, you guys are just liars. You're the fucking liar. You're the fucking liar, okay? And anyone who calls, what about the way he treats women? I mean, like, come on. If you're still with this fucking asshole, then there is something wrong with you. So it's like, we all know what he is. He's a disgust. And now he's killed people. Now he's killed, you know, but he talks about how he's number one on Facebook. Number one. On Facebook, no, you know what? No one goes on fucking Facebook, you asshole, except for me and my old friends to see, like, who was, you know, how fat the people I went to high school with are. But let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Okay. He standing there with the ratings and the, how can you support him? And McConnell, fuck you, you ugly piece of shit.
So Judy.
Fuck you. Yeah.
I was contemplating, your visit today on the show and it occurred to me, like, your kids are out of the house. They're not, I mean, maybe you have,
no, they're here,
but wait, aren't they both?
Well, I have one. No.
One's college.
So Ben, Samuel, yeah. I have Ben here with me. He's the one, I don't know if you saw it, was in the Jerusalem Post yesterday.
I did not.
He will be playing Division I basketball for Tulane.
What?
Next year.
What?
Yeah. Paul Jew. Yep.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Ben's going to Tulane. He's playing Division I basketball.
Holy
and Henry
crap.
Is, he's at his girlfriend's family's house in Connecticut. But he graduated. So he's 23. The other one's 18. The 18-year-old is here with his girlfriend. And, you know, I have to say, I have never, you know, my whole life, it's like we have dinner and then I go out and do a set. You know, I haven't ever had this much time. And it's kind of fun. We play games and we cook and, you know, but fuck him. Okay? Fuck him.
I, you know, because I was thinking about this and I was like, I don't understand. How is it that Judy is like sort of, you know, got kids that have more or less left and the one that's there is like completely self-sufficient? Didn't our kids go to school at the same time? How come I'm like in the midst of like this?
Wait, how old are your kids?
14 and 7.
No, you saw them in the diner, Sam.
No. No. We were at the same elementary school at one time.
Okay, how old are they? Go ahead.
14. It was my daughter, probably was like in kindergarten when
okay.
Your son was
all
probably
right,
in fifth
and
grade.
He was in sixth grade or something. Yeah, fifth grade or whatever.
Well, so mm-hmm. You're basically just living the life, it sounds like. Sounds like you're at a yoga retreat.
No money, with all my gigs canceled. All my gigs canceled. All of them. Every single one of them canceled. Every single one of them because of that fucking piece of shit. And now we find out Mnuchin was living in the fucking hotel for how long? 6 months? 3 months? And we were paying for the Secret Service. They're all fucking assholes. Jared Kushner is a piece of crap. Hi.
Hi. He is Kushner.
I just don't understand it. It's like... This and him talking about the polls, you know, the polls are, I don't look at the polls. Yes, you do look at the polls. Shut the fuck up, you fat piece of shit. But can I just say something? Like, Is there any way that he is going to be able to cheat enough to win? Go.
I mean, maybe. Judy?
If we... Yeah, I can't go on. I can't go on. I can't take another fucking 4 years of this lying bullshit. And now they want to go back so they can approve judges. Fuck you. How about all these motherfuckers they don't want to be told what to do with their bodies. Okay? So they're storming the fucking Michigan State House with their guns and yet, you know, I'm not allowed to have an abortion. Go fuck yourself, you motherfucking hypocritical. Take your gun and shove it up your fucking ass while you drink your Clorox. Hello?
Hi. Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think I get your point. I think.
Yeah.
You.
I just the amount of stress. Okay. So let's just take this situation. We all know he knew about it. He was like, it's never going to happen. And we all know he just lies on a daily basis. He harasses women, especially female journalists. And he's a fucking dictator and a liar and the ventilators. And, you know, okay, that's fine. But the fact that people are living in the subway, people... You know, that these people who are doctors and nurses and working in grocery stores and putting their lives on the line for other people, for the rest of, you know, they're public servants. They are public servants in the true sense of that term, public servants. And this motherfucker is, you know, still don't air him anymore. Stop giving him so much fucking. It's like we're addicted to this. What did he say? What did he say? What did he say? Stop it. Just stop it. Don't give him the fucking platform.
Yeah. I mean, how would you, how can they do that? How can they not, you know, cover this? Or, I mean, I guess they've decided not to because they're just, it's just like campaign rallies at this point.
Well, that's what they are. And he's basically said that. And then he's yelling at his campaign guy, you know, about his poll numbers. And it's like, what did he didn't do anything? Your campaign manager? You're the fucking asshole. When are you going to realize you're the fucking asshole and you're causing this? But I do have a good story. So my neighbors who live in New Jersey, my friends who live in New Jersey, they have a house there. They live in New York too. Anyway, so they're at their house in New Jersey and they're in South Jersey and there's a neighbor of theirs that has always for the past 4 years had a Trump sign and a big flag, like always. And they walked by there the other day and they took it down.
Now, do you think they took it down because they didn't want to be seen as supporting him because they don't support him anymore? Or they took it down because people are even that much more angry about it?
Okay, don't ask me these questions, Sam. I am wondering, I am hoping they took it down because they're done. They realize he's a fucking liar, that, you know, everyone, you know, knows someone with corona. And now if you have a sore throat, you're like, fuck, I'm dying, you know, because of this fucking piece of shit.
Yep. Yeah, you know, Matt was just saying to me, that comedians, he was interviewing Judah Friedlander the other day. And
I love Judah.
Well, yeah. Matt realized like stand-up comedians are the most sort of media visible sector who are really, really damaged by this thing.
So, you know, because we cannot do our art without an audience, you know, even the process of creating the art needs an audience. And you watch these late night hosts struggling because they're getting no feedback.
Right.
And this motherfucker is standing. It's awful. And we're the truth tellers. We're the fucking truth tellers. By the way, pre-order my book. Yes, I can say that.
Well,
to the comedians.
What is, tell us about your book. That's good news.
So, yeah. So I wrote a book all last year. HarperCollins had come to me. They wanted a, you know, it's really about the First Amendment, freedom of speech from the perspective of a comic. And it's called Yes, I Can Say That. It can be pre-ordered on my website, judygold.com. It's called Yes, I Can Say That. When they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. And I've gotten two amazing reviews, Publishers Weekly and Booklist. And I just think it's so important that this guy, and his speech is protected. He's lying and lying and lying. And yet a fucking comic who tells a joke is canceled and vilified when they're only, the only goal of a comic when they get on stage is to make the audience laugh. That's what we do. And we don't know where the edge is unless we've gone over the edge and pull back. And how do we do that? We do it in front of an audience. Okay. This motherfucker and all these other politicians like Mitch McConnell and these hypocritical bullshit artists can say whatever the fuck they want because they're in power. And yet comics who are, the goal is to make you laugh, are getting vilified. And we are the last. Satirists are the last truth tellers we have.
But isn't,
and he can't take a joke because he's a dumb shit.
But isn't, I mean, people aren't being, there's no government action, right, that is attacking comedians. It's just audiences are pushing back in certain instances.
No, you know, it's also the left, you know, like the left, this constant, I can't say this word and you can't say that. No one listens to the intent of the comic, the context, things are taken out of context. There's no nuance in a tweet or, you know, and social media has given all these assholes a platform to say, oh, I heard this joke and he said a joke about this or she said a joke about that and it wasn't funny. Okay, that's your fucking opinion. That's your fucking opinion. It's called a sense of humor. It's a sense. It's not like, it's either like a sense of taste or a sense of smell. You either like salty food or you don't like salty food. Okay? So stop. It's a subjective thing. Stop comparing, you know, like saying like this joke isn't funny and this person should be vilified for the rest of their fucking life when this guy is killing people. He's fucking killing people. His words and actions are literally killing people. Tell me the last time someone died from a bad joke, you motherfuckers. fucking.
Well, I mean, he said himself. I'll tell you the last time someone died from a bad joke. I mean, according to Donald Trump, it was when he was joking around about wiping yourself down with Clorox.
No, that was sarcasm.
Oh, sorry. But wait a second. But isn't
he's going? Yeah, we're going to look into that. We're going to look at, and they're all standing there like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to work for this dumb piece of fucking shit. And listen, it's like, okay, you know, crazy guys talking, and then we'll get up there and tell you. It's like, stop it. Or they should have a bell every time he fucking lies. There should be like a fucking, you know, like those bug zappers where, you know, it should be like, maybe he should get a fucking shock. He should get a shock every time he fucking says a bullshit lie. Oh my God, how great would that be?
That'd be actually pretty fun to watch his reaction. But there's two things that occur to me, and I know you've already written the book, so you can't change it.
Oh,
now.
Yes, I wrote a book. Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But is it, do you think part of the narrow berth? And I think I got to be honest, like in some instances, I think it is valid that people push back on stuff that they find offensive. Like there's no reason why people can't express their opinion as well. I don't know why.
Right. And you know what they can do? You know what they can also do? They can turn the channel or not listen to the comic, but they don't have to say this person should never work again. You know what I mean?
Well,
I listen to hate speech. We all listen to hate speech all fucking day long from this administration.
But wait a second. I agree with that second part, but I'm saying staying on the first part, right? Before we shift who's worse in our culture. I think it's like, I have First Amendment rights too, even if I'm not a comedian. And
right, absolutely.
I can come out and say, like, you know, I mean, like, look, for instance, there's a couple of different dynamics. There are people out there who could be like, I listened to the Sam, to the Majority Report today, and Judy Gold was saying some incredibly offensive things about electrocuting the president.
Right.
And I as, you know, the host of the show.
Okay, no one listening to the Majority Report is going to find it offensive that he should get an electric shock every time he fucking lies.
I agree. But we're going to clip this. We're going to clip this. And it's not inconceivable. It certainly has happened in the past.
Right.
You know, some right winger will be like, here's Sam Cedar, you know, chuckling at the idea that the president during a pandemic would be receiving small, but, you know, significant electric shocks every time he supposedly lied. And Sam sees you sitting with a smug smirk on his face, thinking it's funny. This guy should be canceled. And you know what? My feeling is I'm willing to debate this in public.
Right.
Like my show relies on support from an audience, and bring it. If you think I should be canceled for this, bring it. I'm willing to have this conversation in public.
Yeah.
If public decides that Sam Cedar, you have lost your license with the audience, not an official license. It's just like we as an audience are no longer going to support you because we think you're gross. I mean, it's like, you know, as a stand-ups have the ability. One of the beautiful things about being a stand-up is that you don't need much support. It's like you and the audience. You don't need to be sponsored by a big corporate outfit.
Right.
And so if there's an audience out there, you're going to find them. You're going to be able to go out there and small clubs will book you, or you can go book a room and fill it up. And like, nobody's taken away your ability to do that. And the same thing with me, like, all I need is, you know, my camera and this microphone and, you know, a couple hundred bucks, and I'm out there, I'm live. And
but you know what, Sam, you need a little more than that. You need a brain, you need a sense of humor.
No, but I'm just saying, I know, I understand. But I'm saying, there's nothing that they can take away from me. Even if they decide, like, Sam Cedar,
they can't take that away from me.
But that's my point is that, so like, I have no problem with people criticizing what I say on this show. What I put out there, and it is true that as a comedian, you are walking more of a tightrope, right? Like, cause I know, like, look, I'm not creating art. I'm out here. I'm, you know, I have an agenda and I want to serve right. that agenda. And comedians have right. an agenda that's more nebulous, which is make people laugh. And that's more dangerous
laugh.
Because you don't know where those
right.
lines
of
are.
Course.
I get that. But, you know, at the same time, like it's up to the audience as to how much latitude they're going to give in different eras. You know, this is not Lenny Bruce getting the cops showing up at his performances and threatening to arrest him for saying stuff about Catholics.
Right. Or segregation. Or, right. I mean, they got him on the curse words, but they were really arresting him for the, you know, content, you know, and what he was really talking about, the subject matter.
I agree.
That they didn't want. And so.
But is that happening?
And I agree. Everyone's entitled to their opinion, but why are comedians held to a higher standard? Why is it that this person should never work again? And yet elected officials, you know, can say like, oh, that was just a joke and literally kill people.
I think it's because it's easier to judge comedians and you have more like power over comedians than you do over politicians.
Right.
I think that's happening.
Right.
They have more power. Yep.
But you can't shut people up. Like, look, I have my opinions. You have your opinions. And I believe in all freedom of speech. Fox News should be able to continue their bullshit law. You know, like if that's, they have every right to do it. But, you know, let's call a spade a spade. Like when it's a lie, it's a lie, you know?
Do you think that there were these two doctors who were coming out saying like this whole coronavirus thing, we work at a healthcare facility, a private healthcare facility in California. We've done our own research. And this whole coronavirus thing, it's not nearly as fatal as people are making it out to be. It's not really bad. Do you mm-hmm. think that YouTube should have the right to pull down that video?
I think if it's their platform, they should. Yeah, it's their platform. It's just like a network. Airs whatever they want. They cut shit out of shows all the time. Maud, the abortion episode of Maud would never be broadcast right now because of the climate in this country. So if you are working for a corporation, if, you know, could this person stand out in the middle of the street and yell, you know, it's really not that bad, but yeah, fine. But, you know, if you're on YouTube, that's owned by a corporation.
So do you think it would
and
be
they
legitimate?
Have a responsibility.
Do you think it would be legitimate? Put aside the YouTube thing for people to go out in front of that that healthcare facility. I think it's like one of those, I don't know, quick MDs or whatever that is. Do you think it would be okay
yeah,
for
City MD, yeah,
whatever it is? Do you think it would be okay for people to stand outside of it, you know, with like signs saying these guys are quacks, they should lose their license?
They could do whatever they want. We live in America. There's what's his Fred Phelps is going to a funeral saying, you know, God hates fags, you know, for he has signs that says God hates fags at these, you know, these funerals of our servicemen, you know, and gay people. And it's just, yeah, if the haters don't show their hate, you know, we don't have a point to make that we're hated. You know, like you have to see, I believe in all freedom of speech. They have a right to do it.
Well, Judy.
But they also, yeah.
I do too. That's why I like you to come on and talk about the theoretical, hypothetical situation where we would have a device that would, in some way, give immediate feedback to politicians when they said a lie in the form of an electrical stimulus.
Right. But it's also, you know, people need to do their due diligence and read and, you know, and this hatred of what they call us the elites because we read. I mean, seriously, you're entitled to your opinion and you're entitled to argue your opinion, but back it up with facts. facts are important. The truth is important. Only the truth is funny, and only the truth is real. I mean, you know, it's, come on. The guy fucking was saying, oh, we're going to look into, you know, he said it. He literally said, suggested that you should drink a little bit of Clorox. He fucking, it's right there. And then he sit there and denies it and gaslights everyone. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous because everybody knows the only way to get the Clorox to the lungs is to open, is to actually create an incision right in, right just below the bone in between the chest, in between the ribs.
Right.
And then you go in with the sponge.
And then inject it. Right. And you can also use like a needle that you would use to pump up a ball. You can pour it in through that. You know, basketball or football.
Judy.
The needle with the hole at the bottom. Yeah, you can insert that and shove it up your ass with your fucking guns.
Judy, when does your book?
It comes out July 28th.
Is this the cover?
You're in it, Sam. You're in it, Sam.
What?
You are in it.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, you remember we talked about, I had asked you about, you know, some issues you had with being canceled. You're in there.
Oh, in that case, hold on for a second. Wait a second.
Oh, Sam Snyder.
Where's the graphic? Where's the graphic? I like the cover. I was just about to say. Judy Gold. Yes, I can say that. When they come for the comedians, we are all in trouble. Judy. We will put a link to that. Is it available now? Can people pre-order right now?
Yes, pre-order on judygold.com. That's JUDYGOLD.com.
We will put a link to that, of course. And Judy, I'm glad to hear that you are doing okay.
Sam, I miss you. And I have to say that, you know, when I was going on the road, people, no matter where I was, they would mention your show. So loved.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I love being on this show, and I love what you do. And please, I'm asking you to please get him. He cannot fucking win.
I will try.
Okay, thank you.
All right, talk to you soon. Stay safe, Judy.
All right, take care, everyone. Be safe. Thank you to all the workers and the doctors and everyone, essential workers. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, everyone else, go fuck themselves. Okay,
there you go. Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen. There you have it. I guess Freebie Friday, right, guys? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Where is Jamie? Let's bring Jamie.
Okay,
on. One
second.
But before we do, let me just play this clip. We had mentioned earlier when we were talking to Digby about the this bizarre situation we have. I mean, among all the other bizarre situations of states forming PACs to basically protect themselves from the malfeasance and the misfeasance of our federal government. And in this instance, we're really talking about malfeasance. I mean, Larry Hogan, who I do not terribly appreciate as a governor, but in this day and age, better than other Republican governors, is on with Bob Costa on Washington Post Live. He, his wife, I believe, was from South Korea, or at least at the very least had connections in South Korea. So they were able to get tests from South Korea to administer in Maryland. And contemplate the fact that this question could even be asked and this response given in you know, any era that didn't involve, I guess, I don't know, the Civil War. Here is Larry Hogan on with Bob Costa.
But based on my own reporting, you had some concerns about whether the feds would seize these tests when you brought them over from South Korea. Is that true? Were you concerned that the federal government would try to take those tests out of your hands?
Was a little bit of a concern about trying to get these things in. It was a very complicated process. You know, we spent about 22 days and nights dealing with this whole transaction with Korea. We dealt with the Korean embassy and folks at the State Department in Korea, eight different state agencies, and our scientists on both sides trying to, you know, figure out these tests. And then at the last moment, I think 24 hours before, we got sign off from the FDA and Border and Customs to try to make sure that we landed this plane safely. We made sure it landed at BWI Airport instead of Dulles. So it's the first time a Korean Air passenger plane has ever landed at Baltimore Washington International Airport. We landed it there with a large contingent of Maryland National Guard and Maryland State Police because this was an enormously valuable payload. It was like Fort Knox to us because it's going to save the lives of thousands of our citizens. And there had been reports of, for example, in Massachusetts, Governor Charlie Baker told the story of his plane load that came in with masks was basically confiscated by the federal government. And he had to then get Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, to fly a second mission with a private plane to try to bring some of that equipment in. There were a couple of other states that had similar stories. So we were just making sure that that was so important to us that we wanted to make sure that that plane took off from Korea safely, landed here in America safely, and that we guarded that cargo from whoever might interfere with us getting that to our folks that needed it.
The National Guard protecting tests. Is the National Guard in Maryland still protecting those tests?
They are. The National Guard and the State Police are both guarding these tests at an undisclosed location. These things are being distributed. They're helping us distribute the tests. They're also helping in all kinds of other humanitarian needs. We have about 1,300 members of the Maryland National Guard who've been activated, another 800 that are kind of on standby, ready for activation within an eight-hour period. But they've been just tremendous. They're helping us distribute supplies and PPE, okay, helping us with the distribution.
I think, you know, we get the gist of it here. Larry Hogan's not saying that, we brought it. I mean, this stuff is like Fort Knox to us. So we had the state troopers and we had the National Guard there because we were afraid of like some type of Con Air scenario or where we thought like there would be this paramilitary that would come in and take it. They are guarding these tests from the federal government. How effed up is this? This is insanity. And it's not like the federal government is going to go and like, well, we're going to actually responsibly distribute this. They're going to go and hand it to private enterprise so they can maximize profit on it. Like literally the federal government is like pirateers. It's insanity. This is insanity. And the insanity doesn't stop right there. I mean, just the idea that like, it would be great if blankety blank was to, do an investigation about this or start to publicize like how problematic this is. As in blankety blank, it seems to me would be Congress. But they, A, don't perceive themselves as necessary workers. They need to show up. And B, they don't even think like, meh, why bother with like a Zoom setup? I mean, Jesus, what Kyle's been able to do with this show. Find somebody, build something. Let's get some hearings going, even if it's got to be remote. I mean, you got to be kidding me. It really is just unprecedented.
We're getting a reputation around the world as a pirate over these medical supplies too. Latin American countries have accused us of the exact same thing. It's just crazy to see it happen between the National and State Guard now.
It's nuts. It's nuts. Meanwhile, on the other side of this, you know, Donald Trump, do we have Donald Trump's tweet about this? Let's put up his tweet. People have been referring to this as protesting, whatnot, and everybody's made the point that if a dozen or two dozen African Americans showed up to the Michigan State House, armed to the teeth, yelling at cops, that things would have gone down probably a little bit differently. But make no mistake about it. When you think about what terrorism is, where you know, it's one thing about protest to say we're mad and we're going to leverage our labor or our civil consent. We're going to leverage that to try and get you, our government, to change your policies. That's the way you do it in a democracy. That's what makes you a protester. Okay? But when you project that what you're going to, or what you're bringing, is violence, when you threaten violence, that's not protesting. When your displays of potential violence, right? I'm going to blow up a building empty of people, but I'm going to blow up a building as a warning. I'm going to burn this down as a warning. There's going to be violence. If you don't do what I say, that's terrorism. When people show up armed to the teeth to the state house, and they're not even there, this is not about gun rights for them, right? This is about something different. That's not protest. That's terrorism. Play the clip of the protesters in Michigan. Now, you can't quite see there the guys with guns. This is not, and I want to make it clear, this is not, yeah, there we go. This is not guys protesting about, you know, Second Amendment rights or a bill about carrying their weapons. They're there ostensibly protesting something completely different. But they're bringing weapons. Like, what is... what are they trying to communicate with their flak jackets and their semi-automatic rifles? They're trying to communicate the potential of violence. What that is terrorism. We don't say, you know, when somebody blows up a building, there's no people in there, that's attempted terrorism. If they're pursuing a political agenda, this is what the definition of terrorism is. They are trying to terrorize the people there, intimidate them through violence, not leveraging their labor, not leveraging their civil obedience. They are literally coming there and saying, we got these guns. We got these guns. It's a threat. It's a threat of physical violence. And so how would the president of the United States react to this? We have his tweet. The governor of Michigan should give a little and put out the fire. These are very good people, but they are angry. They want their lives back again safely. See them, talk to them, make a deal. What kind of deal? We had a deal with the people because they show up with guns? What? How about you make a deal and expand unemployment for them? They want their lives back. Why don't you make a deal and make sure that they can pay their rent or that they're not going to get in trouble for not paying their rent? What are they going to do? Shoot the virus? They're going to shoot it? They can clearly go out and about. Why don't they sit in the middle of the town square and protest and start encouraging other people to come out and risk their lives. I mean, give me a break. It really is. I mean, what are we now? 6 weeks into this? 6 weeks into this. The reality is that even in the most infected areas, New York City, it's probably no more than 10 to 20% infected. Probably no more. Rest of the country, probably 5%. So you do the math. If you, and assuming that COVID has been in New York City since, you know, February, 1 month, 2 months, maybe 3 months, 2 months, well over 10,000, maybe, I don't know, maybe 20,000 dead, 15% infected, you need to get to 60 or 70% in New York. And that's just assuming that you can then make that population stable, right? Like New York wouldn't be a place where people come to. I mean, you could do the math as to how long this is going to take. Around the country, it's going to take longer. And we have a national leadership that is encouraging this stuff. It's encouraging it. Here is Dennis Prager. This is just unbelievable. Where is Jamie? Is Jamie here?
Here she comes.
Oh, hi, Jamie.
Hey. Hey, Sam. How's it going on this casual Friday?
Oh, yeah. It doesn't feel so casual. Look at that great new stand you have.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a little bit big for my frame, but I've angled it down, and I think it's going to work. So thank you.
Maybe you need some type of gooseneck. It is a little bit.
I think you should put it on the other side also.
Other side?
Because it's shadowing on you a little bit. There you go. Yeah, that's a little bit better.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
There we go.
All right, that's great. And maybe put like a little logo right on the thing.
That's a good idea. Always be branding.
Exactly. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about the Tara Reid thing. It's always really stressful for me to see it in the news and get angry all over again at the society we live in, which clearly doesn't care about victims of sexual assault. The Democratic Party, which only cares when it suits them politically. And, you know, all the men who've ever wronged me in my life. Other than that, I'm doing great.
Well, do you want to say a couple of things?
Sure. Oh, boy. Well, let's see. You know, I'm going to start out by quoting Marx, as I often do. When he said, history repeats itself. The first time is tragedy, and the second is farce. And I think we're seeing that happen now with the Tara Reid stuff, because it's like a Technicolor replay of everything that happened with Bill Clinton in the 90s, right? Like, I guess I should back up and say first that I believe her. There was a lot of concurrent reporting, which we're seeing come out, and the story rings very true to me, as I'm sure it does many survivors of sexual assault and workplace sexual harassment. It's very normal for survivors to change their stories based on cues they're getting about how they're going to be received if they don't feel safe. Of course, they're not going to tell you the whole thing. I said like 6 months ago on this show that I wouldn't be surprised if Biden had a Me Too coming.
Right.
And people thought that it sounded a little far-fetched, but this stuff exists on a continuum. And seeing the way that he touches women in public, it's not that surprising to me that he'd also do it in a worse way in private. If you listen to him on Morning Joe today, he wouldn't even say that he remembers her, which makes me sick, but is also probably true because, like he said, she was nothing to him. He did it incredibly casually, and also he's fucking senile. So I believe that he probably doesn't remember it, and he's just used to having people cover up for his, I mean, this is like another side point about how maybe people shouldn't be in positions of immense power for that long, because it tends to both attract people who like having power over others, and also it can corrupt people, right? Mm-hmm. So going forward, like, the Democrats have bet on the fact that nobody's going to care about this, and on a societal level, they're probably right.
Let me just ask you what you mean by the Democrats. I mean, because we're talking about a universe of people who would vote for the Democratic nominee, right?
I'm talking about the leaders of the party.
Okay.
The people who, the institution itself. I'm not talking about the voters. The voters largely vote based on how their trusted institutions have signaled to them is a good way to vote. I'm not putting the blame on them. But we saw this during the Kavanaugh hearing, right? I was 100% sure nothing was going to come of it, because this society does not care about survivors of sexual assault. And at the time, a lot of Democrats were saying the right things. They were right about this. That guy should not be on the Supreme Court. Now we have a bunch of people who said that stuff back then deleting their old tweets about it and turning around and doing exactly what the Republicans were doing to Christine Blasey Ford, attacking her character, attacking her as a Russian asset, saying she's got a screw loose. It's disgusting. And I know that I've argued for the Me Too movement in the past, because although it itself is not a radical phenomenon that has a limited analysis, but it can point in radical directions, right? If we turn it into a conversation about power and the wider problems of the things that suck about having to work for a boss who has absolute power over you, right? But I think Me Too itself has been largely corrupted and co-opted by the establishment. We see this with Anita Dunn's relationship with Time's Up. This person should not be in charge of this kind of thing. And its entanglements with the NGO industrial complex, which basically exists to launder the reputations of wealthy liberals and their children. They do some good work, but it is essentially a bourgeois institution in that it upholds the existing power structures. So maybe we need a different kind of Me Too that has a more radical analysis, a more independent existence independently of these bourgeois institutions. I don't know. It's really depressing to me, and it's depressing to see the Democratic Party going the same route that they went with Bill Clinton, right? Like, we have two alleged rapists running for president, and I really think a socialist feminist analysis is the only thing that can explain it right now.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is too that the broad Democratic electorate, I mean, I think in the same reasons why they supported Biden to the extent that they did in the first place, also, I don't know if doesn't care is the right word, or don't, they just want it to go away. And the easiest way for it to go away is for them to dismiss it. And, you know, I think it is indicative of, you know, this dynamic of when, you know, when you have, you know, someone like Donald Trump in the presidency, because you end up having to just simply weigh. It's like, I don't know, it's like the trolley. I don't even remember what the trolley dilemma is, but I feel like it's one of those where, you know, you're just weighing these two options. And those are the two options that you have. And that's problematic. I mean, I think, like, you know, we brought up Al Franken. There was, I think, the assessment at that time was that the political price to be paid by maintaining these standards was not large enough to not maintain the standards. I know there's a lot of double negatives in there. But in other words, I think that if, let's put it this way. I think that if Minnesota was a red state, and there was a Republican governor there who would appoint a Republican senator to replace Al Franken, I think he would have gotten that investigation. I think he would have been there for the Senate investigation. I think that there wouldn't have been nearly the same pressure to get him out. But it was the political price was simply not as high as it would have been had he been replaced not by a, you know, a Democratic politician. And so I think that's the reality of our society.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying that voters are weighing the options right now, but they've only been given one option, right? People who hate Trump and want to get him out. Like, they have been told that Joe Biden is the only option. So I think...
Well, the vast majority of them voted for Biden.
Yeah, because they were led to believe that he was the only option. And I think it's a tough square to circle, but I like to look at it through the lens of depoliticization and ideology, right? Ideology is not just somebody's conscious political opinions, right? We all have ideology. It's conscious, it's subconscious, it's based on our conditions, which are often shifting. And ideology can cause depoliticization because many people in this world, especially working class people who are used to getting so little and just the long march into neoliberalism these past few decades, they believe, perhaps, you know, with lots of evidence to support this belief, that a better world is not possible, right? This is the world that we have, and the Democrats' tepid, rapey but slightly less rapey neoliberal incrementalist politics are the only alternative to a rising proto-fascist authoritarian right? And I also think that certain kinds of fear-mongering about Trump really don't help matters. Like, Trump is certainly bad. Republicans are bad in general. I don't think he is a uniquely bad Republican. I think George W. Bush is definitely responsible for more deaths at this point in time, although we'll see as this crisis progresses. So it's not surprising to me that people would behave and vote in certain ways or not vote, right? Because lots and lots of working class people don't vote at all under the current conditions.
Right. I mean, I think that assessment is valid, but it's also generic. And in the sense that, look, that may be the case. We just ran an experiment, at least if without a long-term sustained effort to organize people and to change that consciousness and those belief sets, what would happen if you ran Joe Biden versus Bernie Sanders in, ultimately to face Donald Trump? There's no surprise that the candidate who came from the last administration and had been a 40-year Democratic part of the Democratic institution was going to get the support of all of those instruments of power that existed. And so there's still a significant number of people, the majority, who voted thus far in the Democratic primaries. Yes, they did get signals from the media. Yes, they did get signals from the Democratic Party that Joe Biden was their guy. In some respects, it was less than maybe one would anticipate, I think, as a function of people like having legitimate concerns about Joe Biden's abilities, just sheer abilities. But that's the reality of where we're at now. And it's also, so there is, it's a shitty situation. And, with that said, right? Like, I mean, because the critique that you're making, I think is legitimate. And in one form or another, maybe not necessarily in the same language, but it's a critique that that I've made for years, and it is the case. But now we have a different reality. We cannot go back 10 years or 15, 20 years and do the work that was yet to be done. We need to do it going forward in terms of like building a consciousness of the way that our system and our government works. I'm not as wed, I think, as you are to the notion that we need a coalition that is sort of like narrowly or constructed, and I don't mean narrow in terms of actual numbers, because I think there's more numbers of those people, but narrowly constructed in terms of like class interests, as you do. But broadly speaking, their relationship to power and their, you know, there needs to be infrastructure built that, so that the next time that we get a Bernie Sanders style candidate, there's just simply more power there, that more than 30% of the electorate votes for him, or that other people come out and vote that didn't vote before. But here we are with this scenario. And so then, you know, that's what sucks about this, is because this is what we're stuck with, for the time being anyways. And there is no amount of assessment. We got a 6-month time frame now. Almost exactly 6 months. You know, we're talking 180 days. I don't have any other answer to say beyond that. It sucks.
No, it sucks. We have our work cut out for us. And I think, you know, the Bernie movement taught us a lot of things. I think my hope is that it ultimately did strengthen the left. But I think, I forget who said this, but solidarity has to be experienced to be believed, right? And we have lots of chances before the next presidential election, before the next any kind of election, to be building working class institutions, to be building solidarity. I mean, the material conditions themselves will give rise to a lot of this, right? We've been seeing strike actions arise seemingly overnight all over the country. We're seeing a massive strike today, right? You talked about it with Instacart workers, Whole Foods workers, other kinds of workers walking out and fighting for their rights. And I think that solidaristic experience will do much more for class consciousness and bubble up into the electoral sphere in a way that it could not simply by running a campaign based around people's material interests.
I hope so. I guess we'll see. There's also, we should say, there's also other sort of a consciousness, protests. People are oppressed. Dennis Prager, for instance, is highly oppressed. You know, they usually has the ability to sit in front of his fireplace with his dog there and opine, and then walk out and have a steak at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, maybe, or something like that. Here's Dennis Prager by that same fireside, vowing to pursue his rights, his God-given rights as an American, to infect other people or become infected himself, and then go on to infect other people with the coronavirus.
Anyway, I didn't say I wouldn't wear a mask. I said I wouldn't wear a mask outdoors. That's absurd. I take walks outside my house, and I am and I am alone, and there was... This is a real tension in life. We have to be law abiding, but if you're too law abiding, when bad things happen, you don't want people law abiding. The best people in Germany in the 30s didn't obey the law. The best people in the Soviet Union from 1917 to 1989 did not obey the law. It's a very tough question. What about all the states that make, or cities that make sanctuary cities and violate American law by doing so with regard to illegal immigrants? Did you ever ask them that question? And I dare say that's a much bigger deal about violating the law than whether I wear a mask taking a walk alone. Indoors, if I go into a grocery store, I'll wear a mask because I'm near people. It's indoors. And I understand. First of all, you can't get in if you don't. And I'm not going to raise an issue at a store. I totally get it. But for people jogging, walking alone, taking a walk with their wife or their kids, it's absurd. And there's a certain level of absurdity.
When you talk about absurd, he's talking about the moral character that's involved in his decision. I'll wear it when I'm indoors, when I'm around other people, but I'm not going to wear one when I'm not around other people. Well, I mean, who's going to know then? If there's no other people around, who's going to know? Like, this is all so performative, and he's so full of crap. Like, don't wear it outside when you're around other people. Show some balls, at least. All you're doing is saying, like, in the privacy of my own existence, if there's no one around, I'm not going to have a mask. Well, you know what? Then no one cares.
Well, yeah, the people who stood up against the Nazis, you know, in their bathroom when they were showering were the brave
exactly.
people in the Weimar.
Oh, I'm not going to. This prohibition about ragging on Hitler? Oh, no. When I'm in my shower all alone and I got the shower on and maybe the radio, I'm going to just really lay into this guy because I'm just like Rosa Parks. Let's play this.
I will not bend to, and I'm prepared to take the consequences. Anyway, civil disobedience in the United States has a very, very, very noble history. Right? Rosa Parks wouldn't sit in the back of a bus because the disgusting law of blacks had to sit in the back of a bus in some southern cities in the United States. Should she have obeyed the law?
There you have it. He is the modern day Rosa Parks. When he goes out for a walk with his family alone, he's going to be like Rosa Parks. But of course, if there's anybody around to see that he's doing that, then he's not alone anymore. And he's just he's just creating an environment in which people infect. I mean, I can tell you, in more rural areas, there's a lot of people who go around, they don't wear masks, and they're just like, I'm not going to get it. Well, dude, it's not about you getting it, a-hole. It's about you having it and maybe giving it to other people. It is like this faux machismo. And I notice for the most part, it's men. And it's ridiculous. It's just so absurd.
We're making yourself the protagonist of history at every possible moment.
Of course. Like, you know, I'm Galt. I've gone Galt. What is that guy with the from
John Galt?
Yeah. I'm Galt. I'm Galt in this.
Yeah.
I mean, do they know that the masks are more designed to protect others than to protect themselves?
That doesn't compute, Jamie. That cannot compute in their brain.
I don't. Like,
there's
honestly,
no other reason someone would wear a mask. It's got to be a selfish thing, right?
Brendan, where are we on this? Because I think what we're going to do is we're going to get some masks that print out that have on there that Czechoslovakian saying, some derivation of that. Yeah, your mask protects me. My mask protects you. Because, like, look, you know, you want to say that to them. Like, hey, guy, listen, I get the fact that you think that you're invincible and you're not going to get it. Maybe you are. But that's not what this is about. And, I got to admit that, like, I'm not going up to people and saying that to them when I see it. But if I had a mask that said it, I'd just be like, eh. And we may do that.
The other thing to say, because we live in the number one police state on earth, is that we need to stop seeing cops harass people that don't have masks. The only reason a cop should be going up to somebody without a mask is to give them a mask.
It's to give them one.
Yes.
It's to give them one. It's absurd. It's absurd.
I love the visual of resistance to unjust laws in America, from Harriet Tubman to Rosa Parks to Dennis Prager not wearing a mask when he's walking around alone.
Right. Is Prager going to say like, oh, and incidentally, this whole thing about shoplifting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that law. Ah, we should. No, of course not. Property uber alles. But when it comes to actually like public health, ooh, that we're in a Rosa Parks situation.
I love the appropriation of my body, my choice that we've seen on certain signs, because it's not just your body, dude. Like, it's a lot of other people's bodies too, and that's not your choice.
Our body's my choice.
Well, the whole point is like, even this, it's not even logically, it's coherent within their own philosophy, which is, you know, my the rights for me to push my hand stop at your nose. Well, I got news for you, Chief. The crap coming out of your mouth, that's what we're worried about. And it's not your hand, but it is your breath. And it is your droplets and it is your aerosolized germs that can reach more than 6 feet. So wear a mask. And that is basically like you not punching me in the nose.
Yeah, like the germs could go in your nose.
And here's another guy who's very worried about this. Very worried about this overreach, this idea that somehow our government could be in charge of public policy. Like, I put Tucker Carlson on, and I want to see Tucker Carlson go and enjoy his steak wherever he's eating it or whatever he's eating without, let's just do this for like 5 months. Tucker Carlson gets to eat food that is not regulated by any governmental authority. He's just going to go ahead and all his food and for his kids and for his family, just no government regulation so that he doesn't have to be living under the yoke of oppression.
But wait a second. Wasn't this all supposed to be about a public health emergency, the latest epidemiology, science? Yeah, that was last month. It's now about, quote, a better life. People in power abuse their power. That may be the lesson here. The arrival of a terrifying new virus from China gave our leaders more power than anyone has had in the history of this country.
Well, I don't know. The Civil War, I think there was quite a bit of power. I think that during World War II, when we rounded up people and put them into camps, I don't know if he's still buddies with Michelle Malkin. That to me seems to be a fairly extreme invocation of power. Or when we're putting kids in camps just because they don't have a U.S. passport. That seems to me also to be an exercise of power. Or when we have police departments confiscating stuff because they suspect that you might have purchased it with drug money. That seems like a lot of power. Or the fact that we're locking up huge numbers of black people or just frisking them because they're walking around. That seems also to be a huge exercise of power. Will you pull up the videos that Tucker Carlson did on all of those incidents?
Man, I'm having trouble finding those right now.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, these people need to be aggrieved about something, right? You see it like when they're winning, when they're in charge, they've got stuff like the war on Christmas because that's how their politics function.
When the second wave hits, it's all going to be about the war on Christmas. When we get into the fall, it's all going to be about the war on Christmas for these people.
Hadn't even thought about that. Two great tastes that taste great together, right?
Unbelievable. Here's Donald Trump at his White House show, where he finds out that the director of national intelligence basically had a finding that, surprise, this is not a bioweapon developed by the Chinese. And, of course, that's problematic because, you know, that runs contrary to all of his marketing that he's been doing. And it's, you know, part of the reason why Diamond and Silk are not around anymore to reinforce this this conspiracy theory, but he really wants this to go on. And apparently this guy is so on top of stuff, he wasn't aware that his own directorate of national intelligence commented on this, put out a statement.
Information on where this virus originated. The director of national intelligence today put out a statement saying that they believe it was naturally occurring. It was not man-made. But
who is that? Who is that that said that?
The office of the director of national intelligence.
Yeah, but who in particular? Who was the man that made that statement?
It was a statement that the ODI...
Oh, he would know that, huh? National intelligence. So we'll see.
That would be your director of national intelligence.
No, I think it's... I mean, you'd have to tell me who specifically, who made the statement.
The statement was just put out under the office of the ODI.
We'll see. I mean, I have to see the statement. I just haven't seen it.
But the question I had was, have you seen...
Can you believe this guy? First of all, he has no idea of how our DNA works. It is essentially all of the intelligence runs through the office of the Director of National Intelligence. He appointed the Director of National Intelligence. I assume it's just a nominee. They're going to put Radcliffe in there. Who is the one who's the acting guy now? Radcliffe is the lunatic who we saw in some of the impeachment hearings. But they have some acting guy there who probably wanted to get it out to the door because he knew that Radcliffe was coming in and is afraid of him basically making up lies. But Trump doesn't even realize it. The agency determined it.
It's isn't it Grinnell that's running DNI?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Who is
he's a lunatic
guy
too.
For Germany? Yeah.
Is Trump implying that the Chinese government created this virus in a lab to spread communism or something?
Yes. Not communism. I don't know. Maybe. Who knows what it is? Just to weaken us. Get us on the trade deals or undercut my copyrights.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a couple of phone calls, and then we got to start to wrap this week up. Jamie, do you have a favorite number you'd like to start with? Let's do this. 810.
Sam?
Yeah? Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey. This is Matthew from Michigan.
Matthew from Michigan. What's on your mind?
Crime Lake, Michigan. Oh, many, many things. I was just going to ask you, what do you think is going to happen down the road here? I know it's kind of weird trying to look into a crystal ball, but with Fox News and everything making everything worse all the time, I don't know. 2 or 3 years down the road, what do you think? I'm about your age. I have a daughter. I work for the post office. I'm walking a mail route right now. And I don't know, man. It don't look good for this country. I mean, I don't know what to say. Just down the road, you know?
I mean, I imagine it didn't look so great in the 1860s either, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And, And there, you know, there's definitely been periods where it doesn't look good, but I honestly, like, I have no idea. If someone was to come from the future and just go like, yeah, by August, the aliens had attacked, and then the Democratic nominee, Oprah Winfrey, she was able to deal with them after they accidentally, you know, annihilated a third of the planet's population. She was able to reason with them. And based upon that, yeah, she was elected president. I would say like, okay, yeah, I buy that. Like, I'm like, you know, I don't know what to tell you. All I can tell you is that,
well, that's a very facadist outcome, Sam.
I'm just throwing out scenarios now.
I know it's silly, kind of silly, but I kind of want to ask you, cause you're pretty politically savvy. I've been listening to your show now for the last 3 years. And you got really good insight on the politics of all this. I'm learning a lot from you guys, but I don't know. This is their chance to close the post office.
Let me tell you this. I think what the Republicans do much better than the Democrats, and I have a couple of different theories as to why the Democrats do this. Partly, I think because they represent different interests than I want them to represent, or that we, you know, assume they do, or incompetence, or some measure of both that influence each other. But what the Republicans do is they stake out positions that are extreme, so that when they negotiate, they are looking like they're giving ground. So when the post office gets its funding, I would not be surprised to see that AFSCME is undercut in some fashion, or pensions are undercut, or there is some type of privatization, or that like there's a presidential board that operates, there's going to be something that is going to be, look, this is a long-term project for them. They've wanted to go after the post office for decades and decades and decades. And everything that they're doing now is a function of what they did 15 years ago in 2006. I mean, you know this. And so they are very good at, like, my job. Mitch McConnell looks at his job and he's like, my job is just to push the ball a little bit forward. And he's so aggressive right now that he's like, you know, McConnell wants to go down in the Hall of Fame, which is, I got 180 judges in. I'm going to get this to 200, 250 by the time Donald Trump is done with his first term. And so hang in there. I appreciate the work you're doing, man. Thank you. I know it's
you guys keep up your work, too. You guys give me hope every day.
All right. Well, I'm glad. Thanks again. Thanks for calling. Jamie, pick a number.
7.
Bingo. That was actually right next in list. 713 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling in from Houston, Texas. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we can. Very well. What's your name?
Awesome. My name is Alex. Been listening for a year. Really enjoy y'all's show.
Thanks.
A couple of days ago, I had was listening to y'all's conversation about y'all were talking. It was a little bit about UBI and a little bit about Biden. I kind of wanted to fit in a little something I had been reading back in 2015. Is it all right if I share a little excerpt from
sure.
a certain?
Sure.
Okay. Well, first off, I want to touch on the UBI. Look up on Google to anyone out there. There's a little essay that's free. It's a PDF written in 1994. It's called The Capitalist Road to Communism. Very interesting about UBI. Someone in Norway, they wrote it back in 94. It's really interesting. It's like 8 pages, but it's check that out. Also,
Peter Fraes has also written similar things, I think.
I'm sorry, what's the name?
Peter Fraes.
F-R-A-S-E.
Yeah, he's written a piece with a similar thesis for Jacobin, and he sort of expands it a little bit in his book For Futures. I find it a super interesting idea.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to check that out. Thanks for the name.
I have some criticisms, awesome. But okay. I'm into it.
Yeah, I know. Same. It's interesting. It's kind of, it feels like an ancient text of 1994, like last millennium. Oh my goodness. They were talking about that back then.
All right, let's get to your point, Alex.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So may I introduce to you a guy named John Pilger. Maybe you heard of him. It's kind of like the Australian version of Noam Chomsky. And he published a book called The New Rulers of the World, and published 2015. And there the name Hunter Biden shows up. And so to any Democrats, Republican out there listening, feel free to take notes. The devil hates when you take notes. Let me go ahead and get that quote for you here. It says, above all, they want Ukraine's mighty neighbor, Russia. Remember, we're talking about Hunter Biden and the corruption over there.
Huh?
They want, this is the long game here, they want to balkanize or dismember Russia and exploit the greatest source of natural gas on Earth. As the Arctic ice melts, they want control of the Arctic Ocean and its energy riches and Russia's long Arctic land border. Their man in Moscow used to be Boris Yeltsin, a drunk who handed his country's economy to the West. His successor, Putin, has reestablished Russia as a sovereign nation. That is his crime. Of course, I'm not a Putin fan, but at the same time, it's very interesting to see how the whole Biden, the long game that plays out in all this. And Pilger goes on to quote Highwell Williams, who said, it's a nice and convenient myth that liberals are peacemakers and conservatives the warmongers. But the imperialism of the liberal way may be more dangerous because of its open-ended nature, its conviction that it represents a superior form of life. And Sam, I'm going to send you a screenplay probably by the end of the when the vaccine comes out. You're going to be the young Noam Chomsky.
Oh, all right.
Biopic of Noam Chomsky.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Let me know if that gets off the ground. All right. Appreciate the call, Alex.
All right. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Thanks. Let's go to the phones. Call from an 847 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Josh from Chicago.
Josh from Chicago. How are you, Josh? I hope you're staying safe. We don't have much time.
I'm doing good. How are you? Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Josh.
Hey. I just wanted to talk about the Biden thing, the accusations. I think the thing that was really disgusting to see was like seeing all these people who I've admired, Stacey Abrams in the past, basically doing their Lindsey Graham impressions of like what the Republican Party did under Dr. Ford, or with Dr. Ford. But like, I also think this brings up a larger problem in that the next time Republicans run someone who has credible sexual assault allegations against them, Democratic Party has lost the moral high ground to like actually have an investigation. I agreed with the Franken thing largely because that's what actually one of the things that helped defeat Roy Moore was that at least the Democrats looked like they had a moral high ground in this, in that case. And the Democrats have kind of just lost that. I obviously know that Bernie won't get, it's unlikely Bernie will get the nomination, but it's actually pretty damaging for them to like run Biden, and that there's a lot of risk here, especially with like the future of just the next time the Republicans run.
I think the calculation has been made by not just the Democratic establishment, but by broadly speaking. Maybe saying society is too broad, but broadly speaking, that Donald Trump, nobody cared. Not enough people cared about Donald Trump. You know, what was just obvious about Donald Trump in this regard was not enough to keep him out of the White House. Appreciate the call, Josh. Got to jump.
Yeah, I think the Democrats lost the moral high ground a long time ago. I mean, look at what happened with Anita Hill. Biden was directly involved in that. Look at what happened with Bill Clinton. They never had the moral high ground to begin with. But I doubt that it's going to make a difference in the grand scheme of things because, like we've been talking about, people accept the world as it is. And they're like, well, what are we supposed to do about it? Trump is worse. So we're going to vote for Biden. And that's what we're looking at right now.
Yeah. Well, Trump is. Appreciate the. That's it. I'm sorry, callers can't get can't do more today on calls. I've got child rearing duties staring me directly in the face. Yes, I mean I think that is the problem. Donald Trump is, I think, so much more, particularly in the context of coronavirus. I mean, it would be a very different situation right now if we were not all in lockdown and a pandemic. I mean, if this was, I think Sanders would still be in the race as of a week or two ago. And I think it would be a very different situation. But not only do we not have it on that side of the ledger in terms of what to respond with, the other side of the ledger is that what we're going through now, this pandemic, has also revealed, you know, I think you were here when I read the, now I can't even remember. What's that?
Oh, sorry.
I can't remember his name now.
What are you talking about?
From Left Business Observer.
Doug Henwood.
Yeah, with Henwood's piece about, you know, saying like it is self-evident that even a neoliberal stooge like Joe Biden or whomever would not have left us this open to a pandemic in the way that Donald Trump has. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's like we talk about immiseration. What this is going to leave us, this is going to set us back in a lot of ways, unless we get super lucky and there can be some type of shift here. But the statement that Donald Trump is that much worse than Joe Biden has never been more true on that end of the ledger, and on the other end of the ledger, in terms of like the ability to deal with this is less than it would be if this wasn't happening in terms of this pandemic. And I think that we're going to pay a price for this. Even if Joe Biden gets past this and gets elected and Donald Trump goes away, we're going to pay a price as a society, for Joe Biden moving forward. It's not going to be as big of a price as it would be if Donald Trump wins, but it is.
It's incredibly demoralizing.
It's a crap show. But folks, we will endeavor to persevere, I guess. Jamie, stay safe this weekend. Matt, Brendan, stay safe this weekend. You folks out there, stay safe this weekend. We will see you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.